Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Denise Michaud, an independent insurance broker specializing in long-term care planning and your host for today's Grown-Ups Forum. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Richard Houston. Dr. Houston is a graduate of Brown University. He holds a doctorate in education from Clark University with his postdoctorate training in psychology. Dr. Houston founded Health Alliance Partners, which creates and implements strategies to promote healthy lifestyles with innovative technologies and entertaining education. Particular attention is given to the psychological aspects of sustaining behavior that improve the odds of maintaining cognitive acuity after 50. His talk is titled Cognitive Dimensions of Healthy Lifestyle Habits. Please welcome Dr. Richard Houston.
Thank you, Denise, and thank you all for coming. I think that I can move if I go. Welcome. I'm glad we didn't try to do this last night. I think we would have had a much more challenging time attracting anyone. You may consider this an episode of Mystery Theater because we have a mystery to solve this evening. And I'm not sure we'll unravel the mystery entirely, but hopefully we'll dig into it a little bit. The other part of this slide that I like is that the metaphor of a stage is very relevant to the presentation. And it's something that I will refer to at several points in the next 40 or so minutes. The first thing I want to do is zip through the landscape, which most of you will be familiar with in terms of current trends. So I'm going to blow through that. I'm going to talk about findings of a survey that we did in Silicon Valley, which is very relevant for our purpose tonight. We will put our finger on the conundrum and identify what we have to solve before the end of the evening, or try to. I will talk also about what I call cognitive disabilities. And this is key to making any sense of this, I believe. And we will spend some time talking about the path forward as well. Where do we go from here and what should we be doing? I'll talk mostly about brain health, but basically these issues relate very much to cardio health, endocrine health, and immunology, immunological health as well. But I'll spend most of my time talking about the brain. I'll end up talking a lot of, or mention walking, but you can think of swimming or biking or anything that involves active habits. I'm not sure we'll levitate a table or a chair tonight, but we will try to figure out and understand how something that we can see takes place that we don't understand, which is a bit of a parallel to that. Okay, a little bit about the landscape, a quick tour. In California, the incidence of obesity is a quarter of the population. And relative to many other states, that's quite decent, respectable. Because in places like Mississippi and Louisiana, you have a third of the population. In the last 30 years, the number of Americans with diabetes more than tripled. And in that same time frame, three decades, deaths from dementia have gone up 66% for men and 92% for women. The Alzheimer's Association says that dementia cases will triple by 2050 unless we come up with some breakthrough solution to preventing the current path forward. And that means there are a lot of people who are suffering from that tragic disease. The cost of care in the United States, Alzheimer's, this year, $214 billion. Compare that to a California state budget of $150 billion. The cost of Alzheimer's care by 2050 is astronomical and, frankly, unmanageable. The good news out of the University of California, San Francisco, is that they believe up to half of the cases of dementia can be prevented. That's the good news. Tom Frieden, who unfortunately became rather well-known in the press over the last 3 weeks due to the Ebola problem, has been quoted to say that being active is the closest thing we have to a wonder drug. The benefits of activity are very well demonstrated in terms of behavioral health as well. There are repeated studies that demonstrate that exercise on a consistent basis will alleviate significant components of depression. And that's not because exercise generates more dopamine or neurons. It's how that dopamine is used by the receptors in that synapse connection between neural connections, neural axons. Now, we're going to get into results of a survey that I did in the last year. We had a sample of 1,600 people, and basically most are from Santa Clara County, Silicon Valley, and a few hundred are from Redwood City. Over 700 of those respondents are over 50. However, these trends are true for both groups. More than half of the sample is less than satisfied with their current fitness status. 95% of those understand the connection between physical activity and mental acuity, brain health. And 90% of the group that's less than satisfied are motivated to improve their fitness. This is a comparison between a group of people who exercise regularly and non-exercisers, people who do not exercise regularly. The group who exercise regularly use a plan. They have a defined plan and they use it. And obviously, the percentage of people who are non-exercisers don't, relatively speaking. Now, it's correlational data. We can't say A causes B or because B may be causing A, but there's a strong association between the two. And the process or the topic of planning raises lots of questions. For instance, do you create a plan that's outcome-focused? Outcome would be losing weight. That's an outcome. Outcome would be covering a certain distance in a certain time. So you can say you're going to walk 2 miles in X number of minutes. That's an outcome or process. And the time frame is something we'll talk about because the time frame in this whole area is critically important. Oh, my. That's interesting. Wow. This is one of the key points of the entire presentation. Here we have a comparison. I think we're on a Mac. We're translating. This is the group that's pleased with their current fitness, and that's a group that's not pleased with current fitness status. And so the first bar, when I fall short of meeting my expectations, I tend to get discouraged and self-critical. People who are pleased, about 1 in 5 have that experience. People who are not pleased, about 3 in 4 have that experience of getting discouraged and self-critical. The green, I tend to give up easily when I hit obstacles in attempts to sustain healthy lifestyle habits. Basically, the same comparison. What this does is it gets us right into the cognitive behavioral model. The cognitive behavioral theoretical perspective has, as you likely know, become dominant in the practice of psychology in the last 20 or 25 years, has displaced psychoanalytic and behavioral to a large extent, which has really become a bit of a sideline, and the cognitive behavioral model has become dominant. And the question here for us is the interpretation we give to something, the interpretation and meaning that we give to any particular event, whether that's going out on the town for a double-double and a big serving of fries, or whether it's missing 2 weeks of any kind of physical activity or exercise. Those are events. Each of those are events. We give meaning to that event. How we interpret that event will influence how we respond in the future. And as we saw, there are a significant number of people who are less than active on a consistent basis who tend to interpret those events in a way that they give up. Oh, heavens, we lost this completely. Okay, well, what this says is it's a graph that's supposed to be in 3 pieces, but we'll just pay attention to the text on this graph, okay? I apologize for this. I didn't know we were going to Mac. One of the items that we had in the survey was, if you had more specific information about the particular needs and priorities of your personal status, would you be more likely to be more active? And half of the people said yes, specific information would be helpful. Another quarter said they might, and another quarter said not really. Now this becomes very important when it comes time to say, okay, what are we going to do about all this? And we'll get to that, and I'll try to bring up that Google point. So, here's our mystery. Among seniors who are less than satisfied with their current fitness status, 90% of whom are motivated to improve, more than half do not exercise regularly. So here we have people who acknowledge that they're not satisfied, they say they're motivated, but more than half of them are not active on a regular basis. Now, if we go back to Tom Frieden's statement that regular activity is the closest thing we have to a wonder drug, this becomes very, very relevant. If we extrapolate the ratio of this data to the California population, we're talking almost 10 million people who are not pleased with their status, motivated to improve, but don't exercise on a regular basis. One of my current heroes is the chair of the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences at the Harvard School of Public Health, Ichiro Kawachi. And he was asked in an interview recently that public health often starts out with good intentions but fails to change people's behavior. Why? And he replied, because many public health theories assume that humans are rational, and they're not. I'm sorry, that's blocked up here. That's what it says. Assume that humans are rational, and they're not. Our thought processes are automatic. Our behaviors are ruled by emotions. And in many cases, those emotions are manipulated by advertisements. This is a clinical psychologist from the University of Michigan who says that every decision we make about eating is influenced by factors that are not in our conscious awareness, or what I refer to as center stage. Conscious awareness is what I call center stage. And what this person is saying is that many of the factors influencing our decisions about what to eat are taking place offstage or backstage. So there's something going on that we are not aware of, and we're not managing very well. And as in most cases, somebody from the field of literature said this way before the scientists got to it. And this is a quotation from Herman Melville that I just found to be absolutely compelling. This is Ishmael. As you know, the book starts, Call Me Ishmael. And Ishmael is in New Bedford before he goes on to Nantucket, where he will sign on with the Pequod. And he's explaining why he's going whaling. After having repeatedly smelt the sea as a merchant sailor, I should now take it into my head to go on a whaling voyage. He's explaining to the reader. This, the invisible police officer of the fates, who has the constant surveillance of me and secretly dogs me, and influences me in some unaccountable way, he can better answer than anyone else. Are we rational? 60% of people identified in a research study by the Archives of Surgery said that they believe in divine intervention, the ability of divine intervention to save patients who are in a vegetative state. Someone who works for a laboratory, who does all the blood work, you know, we all have blood work taken, we get the results back. Well, somebody's back there analyzing all this. And the results show that 63% of us do not follow doctor's orders, in that the blood samples do not indicate that we're taking the medication at the prescribed levels, or we're taking the medication and taking some other stuff too. Faith healing is a fun topic to address when the topic of rationality comes up. What happens there? You know, the proximity and the laying on of hands produces ostensibly some kind of symptom alleviation, or in some cases, allegedly, a miraculous cure. One of my favorite articles was published in the American Anthropologist a long time ago by Mr. Cannon, who I think I've since learned was associated with Stanford. And he documented several instances of people in non-Western societies who had been cursed by a shaman or a witch doctor. And within a day or two, they were dead. What happens in placebo research? Okay, now the placebo research is absolutely positively well documented, and people have rates of recovery and improvement to a large extent with placebos that compare to actual medication. This has real consequences. The Ohio State University identified in a research program that patients with magical beliefs and magical thinking skip cardiac rehab sessions more frequently. So there's apparently belief in something other than the health regimens that have been prescribed in order to promote recovery. Now, I'm not contending, by the way, that that's not real. I'm just saying it's not rational. It's happening off stage. It may be very real. In the case of voodoo death, it was very real. In the case of placebo, it's very real. So what I'm going to do is spend some time looking backstage. What's going on back there? What's behind this mystery? Why do almost 25% of a population group want to be more fit but not exercise? With enormous consequences with regard to neurological health, to cardio health, and endocrine health. Huge. One of the issues is cultural myopia, what I call cultural myopia, okay? If you grow up in one community or one country and you never see anything but that community or country, you have nothing to compare it to or to contrast it to. So it's hard to say, well, you know, we're more of this or we're less of this. That's why this graph knocks me out, frankly. This is a incidence of diabetes graph, and not surprisingly, the incidence of diabetes is associated with income level. And there's higher incidence of diabetes with low income, and lower incidence of diabetes with high income, okay? That's pretty obvious. What's most interesting in this graph is that the high income people in the United States still have a greater incidence of diabetes than low income people in the UK. Now that's a cultural comparison for you. What is it? I mean, we're very closely associated with England, our cultural forefather. What is it? What's going on here? This is also from a course, an online course in public health that was taught by Dr. Kouachi. And my contention is that there are certain unique attributes of the American culture that influence our habits. Imagine an 8-year-old who's sitting on the couch and this commercial comes on and it says, "Eat like you mean it." What does that mean to an 8-year-old? These are images that appear all over the place. This is one of my absolute favorites, really and truly. Here, you have four houses and house lots with a lawn that's about the size of a basketball court. And you have three dads or husbands riding a green and yellow lawn tractor. very precisely choreographed, by the way. And then, out of his garage, appears a man in a flannel shirt with a couple of days' growth. Very handsome fellow, on his red tractor, red lawn tractor. And it's obvious by the speed at which he travels that his red lawn tractor is superior to the green and yellow lawn tractor. And they're all zooming around a space about the size of a basketball court. And then the kicker is that the end of the commercial, the last 5 seconds, commercial cuts to a woman across the street holding a shopping bag, and when the guy on the red tractor comes out, her jaw drops, and she drops the shopping bag. Wow. That may explain to some extent why 66% of the top-selling vehicles in this country are trucks. I still have this vivid memory of spending, 5 or 6 weeks overseas and flying back into Kennedy Airport. And the first thing that struck me was the size of the vehicles that people drive in this country. It's just absolutely astoundingly different than what people drive in Europe. We live in a motor culture. Everything is motor. No comment needed, right? At least 5 hours a day. Then we have people who trumpet the fact that in America we're free. And we're free to gulp. In New York, as you likely recall, Mayor Bloomberg felt very strongly about this and successfully implemented a policy to remove trans fats from all restaurants in the city of New York. Now, this is because the city licenses the restaurants. And if you want your license renewed, we better not find anything involving trans fat in your kitchen. That was successful. Then he tried to implement and restrict the size of the drinks. Now, this was an individual issue. And this brought out the likes of Ms. Palin and others who said, "You can't tell us what to do." And they won. Now, when Ms. Palin trumpets her patriotic right to gulp, she's not likely to tell us that we're also free to pay 2.5 times more per capita in health care expense than an individual in the UK. And by the way, American men die 2 years before the average American Brit, or the average Brit, excuse me. Culture. An evolutionary biologist from Harvard predicted, or estimated, I should say, that humans consumed 4 to 8 pounds of sugar per year in the Stone Age, compared to what is now 100 pounds of sugar plus. So for hundreds of thousands of years, evolution designed our systems biochemically to operate in a certain way. And now we operate in a completely different modality. Lieberman says, we evolved to be sweaty fat bipeds who crave sugar, starch, and fat. And I can't argue with that. Cognitive disability number two, our time, sense of time and our frame of time. There was a soapbox in the room, I'd be on it. The first picture is downtown Gloucester, Massachusetts. It celebrates, you can't see, 400-year tradition of fishing. And at this point, the fishing industry has basically been terminated. People can't fish out of Gloucester, or they can only fish to a very limited extent, because we invented huge boats that dragged nets throughout the oceans and basically caught all the fish. Now, you think that someone would have anticipated that? We're doing this right here, right now. The people with the biggest business backlog in California are well drillers. Because where we used to be able to go 60 or 70 feet into the ground and hit the aquifer, we have to go 400 feet, 500 feet to hit the aquifer. Well, we're using up the water underground. Imagine, you know, what somebody 200 years from now is going to just wonder. They're going to scratch their head and say, what were they thinking? Michael Lewis was on Charlie Rose in the last day or two. Michael Lewis wrote The Big Short about the mortgage bond market crash of 2008, which destroyed, set in motion a process which destroyed 30% of all global wealth. Now, it's not impossible to imagine that bankers and mortgage brokers had the impulse to take advantage of some short-term payoffs to make a lot of money. Okay? I mean, that's not hard to understand. You would think that somebody would have started asking the question whether this is viable. But it was the rating agencies that continued to rate these rotten securities, AAA, that you scratch your head and say, you know, what's going on here? What in the world is going on? So we have another painful and poignant example of short-term gain. Short-term gain, lots of fish, lots of water, lots of money. And in the long term, as they said about one of Silicon Valley's companies, get out the butter, because we're toast. We'll get to the climate change in a second. This is a fascinating series of experiments done by a guy named Michel at Stanford in the 60s and the early 70s. Here's what they did. They brought kids about that age into a room, and the researcher invited them into the room, had them sit down at the table. There was a plate and a marshmallow on the plate. And the researcher said, I have a quick errand to do. I'll be back in a few minutes. You're welcome to eat the marshmallow. But if you wait until I come back, I'll give you two marshmallows. And you can see, I mean, you know, these kids, these poor kids are like, you know, they're touching it. They're, you know. And some kids, a bunch of kids, ate the marshmallow. And then a bunch of other kids waited and got two marshmallows. Cute, right? They did longitudinal studies of these kids. And the children who are able to wait longer for the bigger reward had better SAT scores, higher educational attainment, better BMI measures. That's like, wow. The ability to delay gratification. So, what does this mean for health? The most important benefits of active lifestyle habits take decades to pay off. decades. So the idea of trying to lose 5 pounds on, you know, January 3rd by Easter is a worthy objective, of course, because we usually gain weight during the holidays. But when people say, well, I didn't really lose much weight, so what's the point? Or another one, I didn't exercise this month, but I don't really feel much different than I did last month. So what's the point? The point is that the health benefits from active lifestyle habits take a long time to pay off, and they're not really visible in the short term. Perception. This is a graph of obesity starting from the mid-60s up to actually 10 years ago, and it's still pretty steep. I took my mother this year, who's 94, to lunch on Anna Maria Island, on the west coast of Florida. It's a very magnificent place, just an astoundingly beautiful beach. And I have to say, just completely anecdotally, I was blown away by the number of young people who were unmistakably obese. It was, I haven't been to the beach much. It was amazing. If you are overweight, and lots of other people are overweight, it's no big deal, right? Not a big deal. But the question becomes, how do we perceive something that really needs to be changed? Anorexics are tragic cases of people who are convinced that they're fat, even though they're dangerously underweight. But their perception is that they're fat. People who are depressed have an exquisite ability to pick out the one criticism among 10 comments that are supportive and positive. This is perception. So this is the veritable frog in the water, right? When the water is turned up very gradually in small increments, we don't perceive the change. We don't perceive that the water is getting dangerously hot. And in our culture, the water is getting dangerously hot because of the amount of sugar in processed foods in our diet. But it's not like we get thrown in boiling water, where the frog jumps out because the contrast is so sharp. This raises a terrifically important issue, which is how do we create the opportunity for people to assess their status in psychological safety? And then help them make a plan going forward. I have worked with two organizations that were very prominent in the health field. And within one or two clicks after clicking on health and wellness, you get to a BMI. Okay? So imagine a 13-year-old girl who feels badly about the fact that she's overweight. She probably gets made fun of. She has a poor self-image. And she clicks on health and wellness. And she puts in her height and weight. And it basically says, "You're obese." "Oh, thanks. I didn't know that."
I was thinking of the mental health equivalent to that. Yeah. What's the mental health equivalent to the BMI? You notice that you're spending a little too much time straightening up your closet. You think maybe you should consult a psychologist. You make the appointment. You have to fill out a questionnaire. Psychologist asks you into the office. He or she flips through the questionnaire and looks up and says, "You are one sick puppy." Is that the way to engage people? I'm sure there are some people in the public health profession who will say that the BMI is valuable for something, but it's not valuable for engaging people. What do we believe? Well, half of us believe that in UFOs. A third of us believe the fact that humans were put on the planet in the exact form that we have now. The Iraq invasion was the spring of 2003, after they were there for a while and couldn't find any weapons of mass destruction. Sometime later, they polled the people, and over half of Americans said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. This is not rational stuff. This is one of my favorites. In 2002, 6 months after 9/11, this video of Osama bin Laden was well publicized around the world. And they basically are discussing the fact that they were surprised that both of the Twin Towers actually collapsed. They said that they expected the top to fall off after the plane hit them, but they were surprised. Now, it was all over the world. Yet Tom Friedman goes, and he was told by everybody he talked to in the Middle East that the CIA or the Israeli CIA were behind the whole thing. People believe, according to Daniel Kahneman, what they want to believe. Daniel Kahneman is a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, won the Nobel Prize in economics. Most of us feel we believe what we believe because we have reasons to believe it. That is an illusion to a very large extent. We believe what we believe because of what other people we associate with believe. The idea that we hold reasonable beliefs is an illusion. Climate. Democrats are worried a great deal. Republicans aren't. That demonstrates it. We believe what we believe because of people we trust what they believe. So if you grow up in a culture with a lousy diet and no physical activity, that's what you're going to believe. It won't happen to me. I've got good genes. I'm going to start exercising, in the fall or the spring. The medical miracles will solve our problem. I've actually done a parallel to Lake Wobegon, where you ask people to write down, everybody in the room, we could do this if we wanted to take the time. Rate yourself as a driver on the road. Rate yourself, excellent, above average, average, below average. 90-some percent of people are excellent or above average. This is one of the most important points of the evening. I'm going to refer you to this with a link. I have a dear friend who I've known for almost 50 years. His uncle and his nephew committed suicide. His sister has struggled with bipolar disorder in her entire life. He, in a phone call, I was out walking, and we were on the phone, and he described cognitive behavioral therapy as life-altering. And he also described it, his terminology, as mechanical. because it's something you have to practice. You have to practice coming up with interpretations that support healthy habits. What do we need to be doing other than wrapping up? We have got to do a better job of understanding the psychological components of healthy lifestyle habits. We have to design a better interface to engage people who are not exercising. We have to educate people with regard to a long-term perspective and inspire and motivate people instead of shaming them. And the research on exercising in natural settings is absolutely compelling. One of them said that in prisons, prisoners with a view of the forest used health care services significantly less than other prisoners because they had a view of something green. A view. If you take something away, take this away. We've got to understand our market much, much better in detail in terms of what they want, what they need, what their priorities are. This is the Center for Disease Control statement on marketing, health marketing. We have got to know more about our people that we're trying to influence, whose behavior we're trying to change. Because if we know about their needs and priorities, we can steer and direct the right information and the right incentives and the right inspiration to them. Teenagers are not going to listen to people like me with gray hair. They're not. They don't care. This is a photo of Alzheimer's, well, not a photo, but a drawing of Alzheimer's brain cells versus healthy brain cells. I am not going to be able to spend... How many people have read an article on BDNF? Yeah, BDNF is Miracle-Gro for the brain. I mean it. Go look it up. BDNF, Miracle-Gro for the brain. And you know how you generate it? Take a walk. You can fertilize, I'm serious. You can fertilize your brain. You go out and take a walk. Trends are scary. We have the opportunity to have a major impact. The analysis of the data points to the importance of expectations, planning, interpretation, and value, and the value of specific information. We have to take into account offstage thinking, the stuff that's intuitive, the stuff that's happening in the wings, that's not on center stage. We need to do a better job of addressing psychological dimensions, and what's going on in the online education world right now is downright exciting. Downright exciting. Look at edX, ED capital X. Look at Coursera. They're terrific courses. Take them for free. Don't feel like doing it this week? Don't do it. It doesn't matter. Terrific, terrific. That's where I got the, that's where I was exposed to the Ichiro Kawachi course in public health. If you're interested in this, especially for kids, check out Zamzi. Zamzi.com is terrific. Absolutely terrific. Some folks in Redwood City out of the Hope Foundation are doing something that's absolutely innovative and exciting. Kids love it. Gets them active. And that's... The close here is from another hero of mine. When I was younger, I could remember anything, whether it happened or not. But my faculties are decaying now, and soon I shall be, so I cannot remember any but the things that never happened. Pure Mark Twain. There is a ton of resources for absolutely free, including lots of videos from psychological researchers at fitnesspsych101.com. You're welcome to log on and poke around. It's a beta site. It ain't ready for prime time. But you're invited to take a look. and I thank you for coming.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Cognitive Dimensions of Healthy Lifestyle Habits with Dr. Richard Houston. Our thanks to Dr. Richard Houston for his comments here today. I'm Denise Michaud, your host of the club's Grown-Ups Forum. I'll be moderating today's audience question period. Dr. Houston, I'm sure we have many questions, so let's begin.
It's that the people who drove the mortgage bond crisis were thinking short term. In other words, if they were able to package up these mortgages, most of which were rotten, and people who understood it knew they were going to fail, they were going to go into default. But they packaged these things up in a security and then sold the security like a stock. And so the people who did this knew very well that this thing was going to blow up in our face, in an absolutely guaranteed blow up in our face. Now, it's that short-term thinking that is deadly for us. You know, if we say after New Year's I'm going to lose 5 pounds, but in March I haven't lost it, so hey, what the hell, you know? What's the point? Well, the point is that your brain needs you to be physically active on a regular, consistent basis, as does your heart, as does your endocrine system, as does your immunological system. But we don't see the long-term payoff. Just like those bankers were not taking responsibility for the fact that this is all going to come crashing down on us, and it's going to destroy 30% of the entire wealth across the globe. Hey, worry about that when it happens, right?
Any other questions? Oh, I'm going to have you speak in the microphones. Just so, because it's recorded, they'll edit.
Regarding dementia, Alzheimer's, and when we discovered all this because of Alzheimer's, what we saw before and what we're seeing now as far as the statistics of people getting it faster now or getting it, is it really any different than before as far as numbers, because we were more active when we had to work on the farm, I'll use that as an example, or we were more physically fit 100 years ago. Do we see as much of the decline of the brain enhanced declining with the dementia onset as opposed from then to now?
My understanding of the research is that there is a difference. Number one, it's happening earlier. And number two, it's increasing in terms of the percentage of the population that's suffering from these tragic problems, neurological problems. So it is happening earlier. The incidence is increasing. Now, why is that? I think you could say that, you know, in the 50s, I was having this discussion. When I was a kid, I would say goodbye to my mom after breakfast, and I'd get home sometime around dinner, and she wouldn't know where I was. I'd be riding my bicycle all over town, over the next town, and over to my friend's house, all over the place. I think that's different now. Kids don't go out unsupervised much because of all the scary things that are in the press. This is Rich Louv's material, you know, the last child left in the woods. He has had an enormous impact on this. rightly calling our attention to the fact that dramatic changes have been implemented in terms of our kids. I've raised kids, and I was very concerned about where they were and where they were supervised, and you know where they were, and there weren't many times when me or their mother didn't know where they were. My mother had no clue where I was. She had no clue. And I was out running around. That's what I was doing. Running around. I was in the woods.
Do you agree that maybe the basic problem is the way human beings are wired, that we're wired to want instant gratification, that if a guy can make a buck selling and packaging mortgages, who cares whether they fail in a few years because he's going to take his money and run? If the kid can get a marshmallow now instead of wait for two later, most will take the marshmallow now, and only the very few will take the will deny instant gratification. Yeah. Therefore, people deny climate change. We'll worry about it when all the tornadoes happen. We won't worry about it today. It goes on, and I'm not trying to apologize for the human race, but it just might be the way we're wired.
I think it has a lot to do with that, a lot. And I think a lot of that wiring is underground. It's below the stage, just like the wiring for lighting and stuff is not visible. It's off stage. And I think that a tremendous amount of our behavior is controlled by that off stage wiring and that off stage thinking. And I think evolutionary, we are misfits. I mean, think of what happened just 200 years ago. People spent the whole day either farming or hunting they were active the entire day trying to secure enough food to feed their family. You know, now we get in the car, we go to the grocery store, we're done. I'm done in 20 minutes. You know, fill up the bags, cloth bags now, of course, fill up the bags. Head home and onto the football game or whatever, you know. I think there's a compelling case to be made for the fact that our evolutionary wiring, the blueprint, the neurological blueprint and the biochemical blueprint do not fit this culture that we exist in and live in and support and promote. And, you know, I don't know what happens, you know, in a place like China with the kind of pollution. I don't know. I really don't.
What part of what does genetics play? You know, if people are worried if their grandmother had Alzheimer's, they're going to get Alzheimer's.
This is not my field. I have a neighbor who works for 123andMe, which is the company that the girlfriend of the Google founder started, and they do genetic mapping. I think genetics have something to do with it in that our genes were designed for a different lifestyle. They were designed for a lifestyle where we spent most of our time hunting and foraging and not sitting on our butt. But the people who are trying to understand this are struggling mightily because there is such enormous complexity in this field in terms of what turns a gene on, what turns a gene off, you know? How does a gene get turned on in a certain instance in order to fight an invading pathogen, and how does it get turned off? Well, in cancer, it doesn't get turned off. That's the problem. You know? So there's just an enormous amount of money behind this whole attempt to understand the genetic piece to this. And I think the complexity is much greater than we've even figured out. You know? I actually went to a Commonwealth Club presentation in Palo Alto recently with a brain expert, and he basically mocked the idea that we're going to understand the brain anytime in the foreseeable future. He mocked the idea. There's just too much complexity. Now, you know, maybe when I'm not alive anymore, some group of people will make, you know, they're making startling revelations all the time. I think genetics play a huge role, and I think our genes were designed and engineered for our species in a completely different era.
Hi, thank you. I have multiple questions, but I'll start with this one. Due to neuronal pruning through adolescence and now we think late into the 20s, there's this kind of onset of a depressive state that needs to be kind of overridden by risk-taking behavior and tons of excitement and social connection, and yet we have a culture that isolates teens, promotes safety rather than risk-taking behavior, sedentary lifestyles, and it seems like that's a big downfall in development. So I'm just wondering if you can speak to a cultural shift toward helping parents and educators supporting more risk-taking behavior in youth and exercise and things that will foster kind of healthy mental processes?
Well, I don't know if this answers your question. However, one area that I have tried to work on is developing better probability analysis. I think when people can be more effective in their estimates of risk. As a parent, yes, I want my kids to take risks, but I don't want them to take stupid risks. You know, I read about a teenager who went to Peru and wanted to do the ayahuasca, however you pronounce that, cure, you know, and that sounded exciting, but he was dead 2 weeks later. So it's a question of taking risks, but taking risks with the likelihood that they're going to produce an experience that's constructive and educational. I think we all need to do a better job of being better probability analysts. What's the likelihood of us encountering a chronic disease, experiencing a chronic disease, if our habits are X, Y, or Z? I think your point is something that gets handled differently in different families. I think there are some parents who really promote risk taking. The question is how you do that in a way where you're tilting the odds in the favor of having the child having a positive experience. Now, that's not to say, you know, that you have to protect your kids from failing. I don't agree with that. I think kids learn from failing, but I don't want them hurt in the process, you know? Tough question, very complex. I'm sorry I did such a lousy job at answering it.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question.
I'm 82 years old. I feel I'm in good health. The reason being, I exercise a lot. I walk a lot. I do a lot of sit-ups. Almost every evening, I do 100 sit-ups, 60 up and down off the coffee table late in the evening, 20 on each side, like this. I've lost 30 pounds in the last few years. I exercised a lot in my youth. By doing that, I knew the value of it. So when I got older, I decided to get back to exercising. It's the best thing I ever did. I think my wife is American. I'm from Ireland, as you probably can tell. You know, I grew up conditioned to think in certain ways. Americans are the same. They're conditioned by their parents, by their grandparents, by the environment they live in. And it's hard for them to change. Most Americans make excuses, like people from other countries, about what they should and shouldn't do. They love to eat, especially desserts. No wonder they get fat. So that's my, and I'm going to continue living the way I live. I walk about 12 miles every day.
Great. Thank you very much. Living testimony.
Our thanks to Dr. Richard Houston for his comments here today. We also want to thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.